wall isn't going to work, but the wall has become a symbol for a lot of things, mainly securing the national border, making sure that the sovereignty of the U.S. is protected. And everybody's down with that. We all get it. But there is still not just that, but the humanitarian aspect that has to be dealt with as well. There's something wrong.
That was my intro. That was supposed to be played a little bit better. But anyway, this is Maureen Enner with California Connection. I'm your Northern California Connection, coming to you every Friday at 4 o'clock. That was a snippet from Michael Steele when I interviewed him at the GOP debate at the Reagan Library back in September, and we were talking about the 20-somethings. Hand-holding them, how the GOP is looking at the 20-somethings versus what the Bernie Sanders is trying to handle the 20-somethings. So I apologize. I thought I had that on delay and I'd be able to explain it better. But anyways, that was Michael Steele sort of talking about his opinion on one of the top issues of our election is these 20-somethings and these kids that are coming out of college. So we have with us Evan Tarver. He's been with us before, and you had written a book, and you were on, I think, last fall, I think you came on with us, wasn't it? Or maybe it was last summer. But anyways, he's written another book that is about the 20-somethings and the millennials. It's a novel, and I think it is a perfect time today to have him on and talk about this, because all of the leading news stories this morning were about, this is the highest number ever of kids over 18 moving back in with their parents because they're not able to go out and get a job that they can even start to pay their student loans back. So I have two millennials, so I can relate to it. And Evan, you are a millennial. So welcome back to California Connection. Thank you for giving us this time, and thank you for writing such a great book.
Thank you, and I appreciate you having me back on. I think it was almost a year to the day the last time I was on, so I guess I'm writing a book at one a year, which I guess is pretty fast or whatnot, but I'm happy to be the resident guinea pig for the show today for millennials, and happy to answer any and all questions and shed some light on our generation and how it's kind of affecting, you know, older generations and, you know, the overall economy itself.
Right. So, okay, you wrote a book, and I'm sorry, the title of your previous book, let us know about it. I'm drawing a blank on it.
Yeah, absolutely. So the last book I wrote is a nonfiction book. It's available on Kindle, in Amazon. It's called The New Meaning of Rich. And essentially, it was a long-form proposal, a way for you or a person to basically assess the value of their life beyond traditional means. So instead of just looking at your life and figuring out how much money you're making and then deriving your happiness directly from that, it provides some alternative solutions to measuring the happiness and value of your life while at the same time still becoming traditionally successful in a monetary sense. So that was my first book. And then this one, actually, it came out May 10th, is, like you said, it's a fiction novel, my first full-length novel, but I wrote it kind of as a parable. You know, it spans both self-help and fiction and provides a blueprint or a framework for people who are looking for their passion and happiness in life, and gives them a plan of attack on essentially how to go about achieving that.
So how did that book, what was the response like, and what did that teach you putting your first book out?
Yeah, so the first one was great. I mean, it was almost like a test of sorts. The first one was self-published. I had heard about people in the blogosphere and on podcasts who are self-publishing their own books to high acclaim, and I realized that having a financial background like I do, came up with a degree in finance, worked in investment finance for a little while, and then moved over into the corporate finance realm where I provided financial services for startups here in the Bay Area. I had a unique perspective in that I was able to really see the allure of finances. You know, I was dealing with VCs and investors who are making a lot of money in the tech space, but at the same time, seeing that a lot of people weren't happy, and a lot of people I interacted with were actually fairly depressed, I would say. And so I went about writing a book outlining these things that I had been seeing, and then also outlining ways that we can measure, like I said, the value of our life beyond traditional monetary reasons and accolades. And that's been going great. It's still ranked in the top 50,000 of all books on Amazon, and that's up out of 4 million plus. So I hold that in very high regard. And it's also in the top 50 for job hunting and careers categories. So the response has been great. Figured I would do it again, and I did. So went ahead and wrote the first full-length novel, which came out on May 10th.
Okay, so you were kind enough to send over the download for me, and I read the first, the prelude, and then I read two chapters that you sent over. And So what I got out of it, which I am going to finish it because it left me really wanting to know what happened to these two guys. But in a sense, these two young millennials, 20-somethings, go out and start their own. They go and work for a large corporation, and they end up going and starting their own business and getting sued. And you do a very good job of right off the bat, you can totally understand what these two characters are about. It's a grown-up situation. They don't know what to do. They don't want to do it. You did a great job when they were in the meeting with their attorney, and the character is like, you know, I wonder how much this is costing and this and that. And, you know, we're just two guys that went out and did this. We never did what they're saying. And now we got to do, you know, it's like, it's a hard dose of reality that these characters are handed. So that's where I left off. I got to read the first two chapters and I do want to finish because I want to know what happened to them. But what inspired you? And how are you? You're a very self-motivated person. I got that from the first show we did together. You're highly motivated, and that takes a lot of discipline and self-control and just being willing to just keep doing it. And I don't want to say that's unique to your generation, because I know my son is a go-getter and he's working on Capitol Hill. He's, you know, but it's not the norm, would you say?
Yeah, you know, I would definitely say that. But I would also say, and now this comes as a caveat because I was never part of another generation before, but I would almost like to say that it is fairly common across different generations as to some people being highly motivated, some people not. You know, I think it's become more prevalent in today's society and amongst my generation, because with all the tools out there nowadays that kind of make life a little easier, whether that be a web app or a SaaS product, et cetera, we've pretty much been able to place higher value on our time. So I think this is the first time in history where the value of time and thinking of time as a non-renewable resource is kind of common. You know, it didn't seem uncommon 20, 30, 40 years ago to put in your hours, work 40 years for a single employer, get your gold watch, retire, and then at that point kind of quote-unquote enjoy your life. Now, and I think it's kind of becoming or reverberating at least through the millennial generation, is that time really is the most important asset that we own, and it's quickly depleting, i.e. we don't get back tomorrow, right? We don't get back the hours we allocate to specific areas. So I think my generation is just much more cognizant about how they spend their hours. So you alluded to in the pre-talk about, you know, more and more millennials moving home. You know, I don't know if that's necessarily a function of the generation, you know, lacking motivation or drive. It's almost like they view that as a way to protect their time in such a way that it will allow them to figure out what they really want to do with their life, versus maybe 20 years ago where you would skip that going home portion and just work a 9-to-5 job that you kind of despised in the hopes that throughout the course of basically, you know, grinning and bearing it, you can figure out what your passion and purpose is and then go and attack that. And that's changed a little bit, you know, in today's world.
So I really like that analogy, but I'm going to argue. I'm going to take a different side. Now, my associate producer set up the show today, and she set it up for 15 minutes. We're going to hear your show is ending. You and I will hear it. Just keep going. It's going to keep on. I will end the episode when it's time. So I don't want you to freak out, but she just made a mistake. It's no big deal. So, there's a backside to our story. I have known your mother and father. I was at their wedding. I mean, that's how I've known your parents that's how long I've known them. I mean, prior to the wedding, actually. And I remember when you were born, and I think you are like a year older than my daughter. I think you're born in January, right? You're born in January?
Yeah, January 88, so I'm 28 years old.
Okay, so my daughter was born August of 86, so she's about 2 years older. But so that's the backside of how, you know, I haven't seen you since you were very little. You were very little. So I can relate as your parents. I am of that generation. They're a little bit older than I am, but basically we were all raised in that same. We were raised where our parents, there was no option to go home. You had to get, you know, if I'm going to pay for college or, you know, and very small percentage of my age group went to college. It was kind of like one of those things that, you know, in my family, my aunts and my dad, they went to college, so we went to college, but it was a very small percentage. Now everyone goes to college. So so we grew up with that. When you're 18, you better have a plan. What's your plan going to be? Because you're not living here for the rest of your life, you know, and I'm not saying everyone grew up that way, but it was really, that was much more of how we were raised. So I always think that the generation before, so, you know, my generation, we didn't like the way that we were treated that way. So we now want to make it better. And so we're saying, yeah, come back and live at home, because we remember the stress and the pressure of having to make that decision and make it on our own. And actually, I think we had an easier time of it than kids today. I mean, trying to just to rent an apartment in the city, you might as well forget it.
But, yeah, tell me about it.
You know, so it wasn't always easy, but it was a lot easier than it is today. And, you know, when you graduated college back in the 80s, you literally from, you know, midway of your senior year, you had a job already waiting for you. They would have career counts, you know, like career days at college, and you literally would be hired before you graduated. So we don't have that either. And I'm the finance mind. I don't really call myself a professional, but I'm pretty knowledgeable on how to look at numbers and stats. And there are no jobs. So there are no jobs. These kids come out of college and everything in your millennials, everything's been rammed down your throat. I feel that your generation is the first generation that has had stress put on them from preschool. If you had children in the 80s, it was highly competitive. It was just, you know, the best preschools, the best elementary, the best private coaching, private this. I mean, we our generation, I think, drained our kids. Do you agree with me?
Yeah, you know, to an extent I would, and I also think you're right on in that you do kind of have to look at the previous generations to kind of analyze the current generation, because what I always think about too, even beyond, which I think you made a very good point about the baby boomer generation kind of wanting to mother and father their kids a little more than their mothers and fathers did. But if you kind of look back, I mean, you know, my grandparents, your parents, my parents' parents, they grew up in one of the greatest depressions in American history, right, in the 1930s. And I think that probably affected their thought processes a lot about how they approach both finance, but also how they approach parenting. And I think to an extent that probably affected your generation as you grew up. And I think that's probably the root cause of the shift into now wanting to help your children out. And then also growing up, you know, with the baby boomer generation, it was post-war, economy started booming. I know there were obviously recessions after that, but kind of growing up in a post-war environment where the economy was really strong, I think also kind of adds that thought process. And then taking it one step further, looking at the millennial generation, I mean, I always think about, you know, I was 12 years old when the dot-com bubble crashed, and then I was, 20 years old when the housing market crashed. So I've gone through, and my generation has gone through, these really, really volatile markets that I think affect our thought processes about how we view money, life, happiness. You know, watching people at Enron, for example, losing all of their retirement savings, and just like that, everything they've worked for is gone. And so I think to an extent that's kind of caused us to value the present moment maybe a little higher than future rewards. And then, of course, all of this creates a perfect storm and results in the things that we're talking about. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, there isn't just one root cause, but it is clear that the millennial generation does think very uniquely when compared to other generations, which I'm sure all generations do. And then that's not even to mention, of course, I'm calling out here from San Francisco. I work in the tech industry, so I'm very plugged into the tech sector. And I just think that just the rise in technology in general has, of course, completely changed the way we live our lives. And millennials are the first generation to grow up with the internet. So I think
exactly.
That also has a huge factor on how we're acting in the world.
Well, I mean, you guys are the first generation for so many things. I mean, if you go back to 1980, I graduated high school in 1982, and you know, I go back and look at that and thinking that we were high tech then, and the space shuttle, and oh my god,
right.
And all this. You know, now it's like you watch an old 60 Minutes clip, and it's like, is that really their graphics? I mean, what the heck is this? You know, but I am a firm believer. I am an absolute firm believer that it is generation, every generation wants to be better than the last. And I think that for some reason, our generation, my generation, which I'm not really a baby boomer. I'm a little bit younger. I'm like a year cut off from being a baby boomer. My mom and dad are baby
sure.
boomers. But I am an absolute believer that somehow in our generation, my son says our generation ruined it for everybody with all the rules and regulations now. But
sure.
I really honestly think that if we were to really sit down and do some type of a study, the baby boomers raised a very cross-mixed, diverse group of kids, you know, I mean, free thinking, and it's just so interesting to me, because one of my, I mean, obviously finance is my what I've done my whole life, but it's figuring out things. I love to figure something out, and I'm always figuring out like the world. Like I can solve the world in 50 minutes on my show, right? But I can solve all the world's problems. But yeah, there was something about that, and I honestly think that when you speak of your grandparents, who I knew your grandparents very well too. When you speak of, you know, like my grandparents, you know, of course they wanted to do better. So they went through the depression, then they raised their kids in the 50s with the best of everything. And then we came out of that generation and we wanted to do even better. I mean, you know, if you look at things, you know, let's look at like for, let's just, I always use this as an example. Let's look at Disneyland. It's been there 60 years. They can't even, it's so popular, they can't even keep up with the massive amount of people that go every day to this park that's open every single day. And I use this as an example as to when I first went to Disneyland in 1970 with my parents, and it was a big deal. And, it was a lot of money, and we got to pick two things and don't even ask for anything else. And, you know, and we just didn't even think about it. And I think back, my kids have been to Disneyland 700 times, you know, and could get whatever they wanted, because I had the memory of going there and I never got those Mickey Mouse ears with the bow in the middle that I wanted, you know? I think my generation raising kids, we overcompensated for what we had to learn to live without. And we actually, I think, were better learning at a young age limits and what you can have and what you cannot have. And I know with raising my kids, I was way more lenient and wanted them to I wanted them to be happy. I wanted them to have what they wanted. And I think that's my Maureenism to the world. I think that, you know, our generation just wanted to do better. And somehow we were educated. We were more educated. We were career driven. Most women had worked and had, you know, very important jobs before they had kids. I mean, there's a lot of factors that went into raising that generation of kids who are now the millennials. And would you agree with that? I mean, I know you're one of four, which is amazing. you know, I mean, and all of you have gone to college or still, I know there's probably still some in college, but tell me, am I off base there?
Yeah, you know, I think you're on base. And as a side comment, my youngest brother just graduated from Cal State Fullerton last weekend. So my parents have officially mothered and fathered four college graduates. So congratulations to them.
Congratulations to John and Karen. Yes, my hat's off. That's amazing.
Yeah. So anyway, but, you know, I really do agree with you. And I actually see a lot of parallels between, you know, what you were saying and actually how I was raised. But that being said, I don't know if it's necessarily a bad thing. I think that there's all the sensationalism in the news and the media about millennials, you know, moving home and living at home till they're 30. And of course, the rising cost of debt and the rising amount of debt principal, right, for going to college becomes a huge burden. But maybe I'm a contrarian and I'm actually willing to admit that that very well could be the case. But looking back on my own life, I was mothered and fathered by parents who I wouldn't necessarily call protective, but they did want to give me everything they could. Post-college, I actually moved home for an entire year, ended up taking a 3-day-a-week internship in the city of San Francisco just to kind of get my feet wet in the financial world. Ended up taking a job at the Berkeley Laboratory doing corporate finance, actually, and moved out to San Francisco. But after that point, you know, I've never looked back, and here I am today, a business owner and an author, generating all of my own income without 1 cent coming from a traditional paycheck. And I could pretty confidently say that that wouldn't have been possible had I not gone home for that year and kind of, you know, reassessed things, you know, tried to figure out what it was that I wanted to do. I mean, sometimes you kind of feel like you're drowning, as I'm sure everyone who's listening can attest to, when you know, you kind of feel like your life's a little out of control and you're not doing something that you want, or you're not doing that ideal thing. Now, we could compare previous generations, like my dad, for example, who just would tell you to man up and get it done. I mean, he emancipated himself when he was 17 years old. He put himself through college working 40 hours a week. You know, he's held a full-time job since he was 15, versus me, who graduated college, moved home unemployed for a year, but now here I am at 28, and I would like to think that I'm more successful today than I would have been had I stuck with that job that I didn't like, that was actually taking me away from the path that I didn't know I wanted yet. But now that I'm sitting here, I know that I had wanted. So, you know, it's a nuanced point, I suppose. There's obviously no easy answer, but it kind of is what it is. And in all honesty, that's kind of the essence of the story I was trying to capture in the novel, you know, Life in 20-something, that there is no easy answer, that you're going to try things and you're going to fail and you're going to have depressing days and you're going to have happy days and you're going to pick career tracks that you don't enjoy and you're going to face bosses who put you down and, you know, make you feel not good about yourself. And then once you find your passion, or at least you think you do, and you go and pursue it as a career choice, you're probably going to fail again, you know, and i.e. in the book, the protagonist and his business partner get sued by a former employer, which unfortunately is much too common in today's world, you know, of American litigation. But that's just a point trying to show that even when you find the thing you want to do, it still may be hard to get there, but that doesn't mean you should stop trying, for example. So I think to the millennial generation, I would definitely say that, you know, you have to test things. And I think that's kind of the point of, or kind of like circling around, is that, you know, if my parents would not have allowed me to move home, I would have had to go out in the real world, get a real job, but that would have been a great way to test what I like and what I don't like. So I think the advice that I would give to my own generation is to get out there and do it. You know, don't view some negative job as a negative, view it as a learning experience in which you will be better off for your next job. So I think it really comes down to mentality, you know, over anything.
Well, again, now you, the age that you guys are and with technology and the internet, and you would never have been able to do this 20 years ago. Because
right.
you wouldn't be able to be in communication with everyone the way you are to write your book, to have it downloaded to Kindle, you know, all these things. Amazon. I mean, let's just talk about Amazon. We could talk about Amazon for an hour. You know, I mean, there are all these things that are out there, but a lot of these kids aren't using them and are not trying. So can I ask you, how do you feel about Bernie Sanders and the tremendous response he is getting by wanting to give away college?
Yeah. So, you know, I probably should be a little more knowledgeable on, you know, his specific policies, but I do kind of see it almost as kind of a reactionary thing. You know, it's almost like, especially out here in California, and then especially amongst my generation, I think there's an idealistic view of more socialist types of policies and governments mm-hmm. that skew towards socialism, because in an idyllic world, you know, maybe it would work. Unfortunately, we don't live in an idyllic world. And coming from myself, who is 100% self-made, especially now, like I had said, I don't make a cent from anyone else other than the people who, you know, pay me for my business services or my consultative services or my book. I like keeping my money, you know, I think that you should be able to keep what you earn and be incentivized to earn a lot of money. And that's things that more socialist beliefs don't quite, believe in, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Well, they don't believe in capitalism. So let's face it.
Right. Right. Exactly. And so, you know, yeah, the whole government handout thing, and again, growing up through the 08 crisis, right, government handouts became almost commonplace. But, you know, I would like to think that when people really sit down and kind of ponder the effects of some of these policies that are kind of being brought to the forefront, I mean, in theory, they sound fine, but mm-hmm. when you implement it, I think it's kind of doomed for failure, especially at the scale of, you know, a country that's 300 plus million people. You know, if we're on a desert island with 11 people, hey, I mean, even communism, I think, would work, right, and on a very, very small scale. But you can't do that, you know.
And they constantly, the Democrats are constantly saying, you know, look at Sweden. Well, Sweden has the population of, what, Rhode Island? I mean,
right,
come on.
Exactly.
This is the United States. But I'm just interested in hearing a 20-something, other than my own two children, because he is drawing tremendous, I mean, overwhelming response from the millennials. So his message is college should be free. You shouldn't be coming out of college with all this debt. Well, of course, all these young 20-somethings want to hear that because, oh, hey, I don't have to pay my college loan back. Wouldn't that be great? Well, you know, that's the next bubble we're looking at that's going to burst, if you want my financial advice, because either the credit bubble with personal credit, or it's going to be this college loan that is trillions of dollars, because Obama took the banks out of giving student loans when he came into office in 08, and only it is now strictly a government program. So what's going to happen when these kids start not paying back? And we're talking trillions of dollars are on the books for college. So I don't think the idea should be giving it away for free. I think we need to go back to these universities and say, look, why has it gone from $2,500 a year to $600,000 a year in 30 years?
Right.
You know, we need to look at what these costs. And the other bad thing is when you put the government in charge of these loan programs, the colleges can charge anything because they know the government's going to pay for it. So it's a lot of people don't realize that Obama took the public system out of it. You used to be able to go to the bank and get a student loan. And there was various ways of getting a student loan. Now you can only go through this government program. So of course, especially the state and UC systems are really going to take advantage of that because they know they're going to be paid back. So it's kind of I don't believe anything should be free, even public education. I think if my mom wrote a check for I went to Catholic, but you know, even if every parent had to write a check for public education, I think they would even be involved more and they would take it more seriously. And they would, you know, look, I'm writing this check which logistically they are in property taxes and whatnot. But I just think that the minute you give something away for free, there's no value to it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I totally agree with that. And in fact, it's kind of funny because I'm almost on the other end of the spectrum and I know this could open up a can of worms, and it's not really a true policy that I think would work, but just to kind of conceptualize the idea is, like, I would almost want to take little to no taxes at all away from me and my paycheck and then just make almost everything privatized. And so if I wanted to use something, well, then I could pay for it, and then I would have direct control over where my quote-unquote tax dollars are going, because they're things that I'm directly using and I am directly taking money out of my pocket to pay for it. Now, of course, at scale, I don't know if that would really work, but at least shows you where I'm coming from in my thinking. And
I've heard that from a lot of people. A lot of people have talked about that because nobody knows how to spend our own money better than us.
Right. Exactly. I don't trust, you know, when I have money leave my paycheck, which now I don't have, and so I basically have to set aside, you know, quarterly taxes, but I just assume it's gone, and I assume that it's not going anywhere good, and that's very sad, but, you know, it's also kind of true. And so when we talk about, you know, increasing tax brackets and, you know, some obscene amount of, like, you know, 80 or 90% tax brackets for, you know, high-income earners, it just scares me because I don't think it's going to fix the problem because money isn't going to be allocated any more efficiently. There's just going to be more money to inefficiently allocate. Not to mention, I think it's personally a detractor from earning more money. You know, out here in tech and Silicon Valley. Yeah, exactly, right. So out here in tech and Silicon Valley, of course, I rub elbows with a lot of VCs, a lot of people who are influenced by money. But that being said, some of the greatest companies in the world were created for maybe less than altruistic reasons, and people were looking for a $1 billion exit, or they're looking to flaunt, you know, a Maserati or something like that. I'm not saying it's good, but when the product or service of the company does provide real value, it scares me a little bit to have these high tax brackets because then it might detract entrepreneurs and investors.
Well,
from,
and that's again what the socialists believe. I mean, Bernie Sanders is calling himself a socialist. He has no problem doing it. And that is what they want to do. They want to take. They don't believe in capitalism. They don't believe that people should be making all this money and somebody else can't. You know, they want everybody to be able to be the same. Well, it just doesn't work that way. And something in along the way is what you said about, you know, giving. We pay what we feel like we want to pay because of what we use. I thought back in 2008 because I was in the markets there pretty heavily, and I lost all my savings in that when Bear Stearns went under. So I was hit very hard. And when they were going through the stimulus process and Congress was voting it, they could have given every family in the United States $40,000 and instead of doing this bailout. And
right.
We were talking about that because I was on the air then too. I had my own show at that time. And we were talking about it as, imagine how that would stimulate this economy. If every family tax-paying person was given $40,000, could you imagine how fast the economy would have just picked up? Why people going out
right,
still,
absolutely.
You know, adding on to their home, you know, whatever. I mean, every industry that was hit, it was all consumer, you know, the consumer products, consumer mm-hmm. market went down the toilet. So I kind of think the same way. We pay enormous amounts of tax. And I was thinking the other day, wow, if the government just gave us back what we pay and we just put it back into our economy, it would be unbelievable. But it's not the way it works, unfortunately. So I was just very interested in hearing what you have to say about these kids that are they think Bernie is the answer. And again, that shows a side of the 20-somethings that I think my generation would have been like, oh, no way. This just doesn't make any sense. But again, this generation is a little bit different.
Well, you know, it's definitely true. And I do want to say a couple things to that, because I do agree with you on many of the points that you said. But, you know, I do think to some extent the quote unquote millennial generation or the feelings of millennials is a little generalized in the media and then amongst the minds of people who are outside of the generation, because I would like to say that although there is a huge sentiment of supporters for guys like Bernie Sanders and people who have a little more socialist beliefs, you know, I live, work, and am friends with many people my age who don't feel that way. And I think to a certain extent, and I don't mean to be crass, but it's like you become a social liberal until you start making money. And then you kind of start to realize, you know, where your money is going. And so as a 28-year-old now working out here in tech in Silicon Valley, I would say that most of my friends do not think that way, actually, which is kind of funny. And maybe I'm just out here in a bubble because
I'm happy to hear that. I am overjoyed to hear that.
Yeah.
The media is just, you know, I think he's really getting the young, the 18, 19, 20.
Right.
You know, I think more of that age that he's really tacked into.
Right. And it really does, I think, come down to, like Ed said, you know, and I was even the same way. You know, I was very, very liberal in my views in my earlier years. And then mm-hmm. once I started supporting myself full time, became much more fiscally conservative. So, you know, without getting too deep into politics here, I guess libertarian is kind of the new buzzword for millennials, because mm-hmm. I think one of the issues is that this two-party system and this black and white way in which we go about looking at issues doesn't really resonate with anyone in the millennial generation, especially myself, because we know inherently that views are not black and white. They're very gray oftentimes. And yet we have a two-party system that doesn't really represent us in either capacity, right? So I would still consider myself a social liberal. So I don't agree with some of the conservative beliefs with some of that stuff, but I'm also very fiscally conservative. So I don't believe in a lot of the left-wing views towards finance and economics. Yet I can't be appeased by either party. And so I almost have to kind of pick the lesser of two evils when I'm voting, either in a general, a primary, or whatever. And I think a lot of millennials feel the same way. And so I think what it is that our hearts, especially with the younger kids, they vote more with their social beliefs and their fiscal beliefs, mainly because they don't really rely on a lot of, you know, fiscal mm-hmm. things yet. And then as you kind of get older, you have to kind of make a decision. Okay, well, what's more important to me? Is it the social issues or is it the fiscal issues? And sometimes they're one and the same, sometimes they're not. But it just kind of, you know, sucks kind of in general, for lack of a better word, that I think our system's getting to the point where it's not really representing many people wholeheartedly within our nation, yet we still have to choose. And so left, I guess.
Right. Yes. Absolutely. And let's just say this political season, it's like nothing. Nobody's ever seen this before. I mean, I'm a political nerd and have loved politics since high school. And I can't get enough of it. It's just so historical. It's so amazing. I mean, California looks like it has 28 million people signed up to vote in the primary. The state has never seen this before. I mean, it's pretty amazing. I mean, it's just something you can't not talk about because it's so unbelievable what's happening with two candidates that are so far to the right and to the left, but who are getting this tremendous amount of support. So, and definitely anti-establishment. So it's a very, you know, my son, who's 25 and he works on Capitol Hill, and he, you know, why do you like Trump? I don't like Trump. Oh, we were having a, you know, conversation. And I said, you know what, when you're 52 and you've been raked over the coals by the government for the last 30 something years with taxes and all this crap, you're going to come back and you like him too. But, you know, you're only 25. You haven't been kicked around yet. So.
Right. And that's kind of, you know, the spirit of what I've kind of just been saying, you know, that we skew left because maybe we haven't kind of gone through those life experiences quite yet. But
that's a great segue to your book, because what I got out of the chapters were, it was just they were put in a situation they just didn't know what to do. I mean, it wasn't, they never thought that could happen.
Right. Yeah. And so just kind of give a quick little background on the story itself. So like I had said, you know, it really is written as a parable. If any of your listeners are familiar with The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho, I kind of modeled it off that, where it's a, you know, a guiding story, or is a journey that follows a protagonist from point A to point B, but really there's real world value and principles that can be derived from the fiction story. That being said, you know, it draws on a lot of my observations out here in Silicon Valley. So it follows a protagonist who, you're right, you know, is searching for his life's meaning. He basically kind of gets allured to the glitz and glamour of startup life out here, essentially kind of wanting to become the Mark Cuban, right, or the next Mark Cuban, at least, of celebrity entrepreneurs. Comes out to Silicon Valley, works for a couple startups, decides to start his own company, and then is almost immediately sued by his previous employer for violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which is a federal crime. And unfortunately, like I had said, it happens in real-life situations, and it happens more often than even not, as I hate to admit out here. So the protagonist essentially thinks he's pursuing this life that he wants, this glitz and this glamour, and then he's immediately slapped down by the same people he had kind of trusted previously. And so now he has to face this huge court case. It's a jury trial and everything that's involved. And at the same time, he's kind of wrestling with this inner struggle of, well, what is really making me happy? Because I thought it was going to be entrepreneurship, and now it's put me in this situation. So if it's not, you know, then what is it? So it's as much a vision quest and a spirit quest as it is this overarching story of dealing with this tough legal battle out here in the tech industry. But the whole point is to basically show the reader and the person that we fail when we place our happiness and our values on external things. So when you're chasing, like I said, fame, glitz, glamour, fast cars, money, those are all external sources of validation and external sources of happiness. And it's only once we're able to truly generate internal self-love and that internal reliance on your own happiness that kind of allows you to remain even keel even when you're getting sued or if you're losing your money in the 08 housing crisis. That's what life is really about. And then if you're able to kind of have that even keelness and take that through life, in effect, you then find what it is that you truly want to do, and you're able to do it with full force and passion in such a way that it then gives you some of those traditional things that you had wanted all along but realized that you couldn't focus on. So that's really the point of the story, and it kind of takes the reader through a roller coaster ride of emotions and of the tech scene out here in San Francisco as well as L.A., or Los Angeles, and then also court proceedings, which is always fun to read about. So
where is any of this based on things that you have gone through or have known or have been involved in, or you just came up with this idea and went with it?
So, you know, it is somewhat observational, but more general observations. So, you know, some characters are embodiments or even caricatures of, you know, an amalgamation of people I've met out here, entrepreneurs, investors, lawyers, and even artists and creative types, because part of the story is actually uncovering your creative and your artistic passion. So even kind of blending people that I know in the artistic community out here in San Francisco and L.A., and then also dealing with some stories that I've learned through friends and whatnot. But, you know, I don't want to mince words. It is a fiction novel. But I think to an extent, you know, all fiction is based somewhat in observational truth.
Well,
and that's really gone.
That's what they say. Truth is better than fiction. You can't write some of this stuff. It's, you know, it's,
right.
Some of these stories,
right.
Hollywood. And if you did try to write it, Hollywood would say no way. But no, this really happened. So
right.
Were you always a writer? Did you always have a desire to write? Or do you just simply...
Yeah, so it's been kind of an interesting journey, and this actually could be a perfect kind of example of what we've been talking about the past 30 minutes or so, because, you know, I'd always been a voracious reader. I've always been self-proclaimed a sci-fi nerd, love Harry Potter, even to this day, you know, not afraid to admit it. So I read a lot, and I got to thank my parents for, I think, cultivating a household where reading was encouraged. And then, you know, I went off to college where I graduated with a degree in finance and immediately kind of jumped into the investment world. And so through my career endeavors, I got really interested in self-help, self-development, and, you know, business books. So I kind of put the fiction aside from a reading standpoint and started picking up a lot of these, you know, ways to optimize yourself in order to increase your output, for example. Got really into the self-development space, and then I started a business and self-improvement blog over at evantarver.com, where I started basically posting weekly articles on just that: business, philosophy, self-improvement, and the intersection of all three. That has been going for about 3 years. I continue to do that weekly and just try to provide insight into basically things that I'm going through. You know, hey, I tried to start a business. This thing happened. This was my mindset shift during that experience. Let me write about it so that other people can learn from it. So that's really where I started writing seriously. That led me to then write my first nonfiction book, The New Meaning of Rich, which, again, I self-published last year and still doing very well, still providing value. And then from there, I realized that, you know, actually, you know, my passion has always been to write. You know, looking back, I've read so much and I've written so much that it seems almost like a no-brainer that, you know, my true creative and artistic endeavor is writing. And so it kind of just hit me like a ton of bricks about, you know, 8 or 9 months ago. And I decided to write my first full-length fiction novel. And so that one's published by Amazon. Amazon's my publisher, and went ahead and wrote that. But I still have that deep, you know, rooted interest in self-development, self-help, and business. So even though it was a fiction novel, I wanted it to still provide the same type of value that I was getting from these nonfiction books, because I felt like there weren't a lot of fiction. There were fiction novels that were a good read, and there were self-help books that were informative, but there was nothing that was both.
But you combined both of those into a book. And I'm going to ask you to please send me a signed copy. Email you. I always get a signed copy. I don't even have, send me one of your first book too. I always request that. That's the best part of my job. Do you know how many signed books I have from, I love it. I love books too. I read, I love it. And so I am requesting your two books. And I'll get you the address, and I would love you to send them over to me. And you actually asked me to do to promote you a little bit, and I was happy to do that. And I'm just so inspired by you. I was really looking forward to talking to you today. And I said it last year when Bob and I worked together, and just how well. Here I am, the radio show host today, and I could get my sentences out, but you're just so poised, and you get your message out, and you speak to the level at which you're talking is not putting somebody down or, you know, bringing them out. You just have a very, it just comes naturally to you. That's what I mean. I could just see you as a natural person to help, you know, your business consultant. You're probably very good at laying out a plan and explaining it and helping the person do the plan. I mean, I just, you're very, very, very poised, and you don't seem like you are 28. I think last time I said, are you sure you're only 27?
Well, you know, I really appreciate all those kind words, because I think, you know, we all have self-doubt, right? So it's nice to hear that, because a lot of times I don't think that I'm, you know, coming off that way. And so I'm glad that I am. And I think, you know, kind of a note to that is it really is kind of a war of attrition when you're kind of trying to pursue the things that you want to. And by that, I mean, nothing happens overnight. And I unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, found that out the hard way. And I guess fortunately, I found it out at this young age. But you know, it's taken me a lot of hard work and effort and time to get to the point today where I can at least come off like I know what I'm talking about. And, you know, and I have business revenue that I'm generating for myself. And, you know, to the listeners and to the eventual readers of my book, I mean, that's what it's all about. You know, it's showing people that it's the long game. It's not the short game. And you're not going to achieve your goal tomorrow. And if you can achieve your goal tomorrow, it was probably too easy to begin with, you know. And so it's just a constant journey, and hopefully I can come on again and be even more impressive next time. So,
well, I mean, you're always welcome here. Our audience, we have a great audience for just what you're talking about now and what you spoke about last time. So in the last few minutes, I have two millennials, a 29-year-old and 25. My son is 25, works on Capitol Hill. He came home after college. He lived with me. He interned with a congressman. So yeah, I was relating to what you were saying. You know, I basically encouraged him, and now he's working on Capitol Hill. So that time that I invested and said, come home, we'll pay for everything, it's paid off. And so I don't want to give the impression like I would never let my kids come home. You know, I did. I have made sure that they had everything they needed, and my son did have to, you know, live at home. But I just think that maybe the media is just overhyping this whole millennial thing. Speaking to you, I have great hope. I speak to my son every day. He calls me every day on his drive home and tells me everything that's going on in the Capitol. And my daughter, she has a very good sales job. She's out, you know, meeting people all the time. And she's beautiful and smart. And so I get re-energized. And thank you for coming on and re-energizing me today, because there is hope for tomorrow. I said quite a while ago on one of my other radio shows, I said, out of the Great Depression came the greatest generation. Can this generation coming up be that generation? Because they kind of have to be, because things things are just not. You know, sometimes I wish I didn't know so much about finance, and I wasn't always so nervous, because I'm very nervous about our markets. I'm very nervous about a lot of things. I mean, this election is going to be, it's going to mean a lot to our markets and our economy. So thank you so much, Evan, for coming on. And I really enjoyed the first two chapters, and I can't wait to read it, finish it, and find out what happens to these two, the poor kids. I think the last part that I read was, you know, getting a cab and walking home and just couldn't, he was just still felt like he'd been hit by a truck. So I'm looking forward to getting that signed copy in the mail. And everybody, you can go to, well, tell them, Evan, where they can find your book.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's actually a couple call to actions. I promise I won't confuse people. So if anyone's interested in my weekly articles, evantarver.com, you can sign up or not. They're there. And then for my books, I'm actually running a promotion right now because of the recent launch of my second book. So if you're interested in The New Meaning of Rich, the e-copy of that book can be found on Amazon for just $1.99, really cheap, worth the buy. All you have to do is type in The New Meaning of Rich into Amazon. And then my newest novel is actually $2.99 for the e-copy just for the next week. It's a special promotion. And again, you can find that by going to Amazon.com and then typing in Life in 20-something, and or just type in Evan Tarver in the search bar and you can find me.
And we will have all of that on our website, California Connection, on our Facebook page, everything that you need to find his book. And again, Evan Tarver, thank you for joining us. We have coming up shows. We have Dina Martin coming back to join us. And we have Mike Reagan. He will be our Father's Day show. He wrote a book called being the president, being a son, not just the president's son. So he will be with us for our Father's Day show. So we have lots of great shows coming up every Friday at 4 o'clock, California Connection. Again, Evan, thank you very much. And please give your mom and dad a big hello for me. And again, tell them they did a darn good job.
Thank you. I will.
All right. Everybody have a good weekend and happy Memorial Day.